Welcome to the Spotlight Edition of the Future of Medicine podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Craig Wright. Join me as I have conversations with some of my favorite medical experts discussing a variety of common health questions. I hope you find this useful, empowering you with confidence along your journey toward optimal health. Let's jump right in. Dr. Clayton Spiceland is a board-certified gastroenterologist with the GI Specialist of Middle Tennessee, located in South Nashville. He grew up in Kentucky and received both his undergraduate and medical degrees from the University of Kentucky. He performed his internal medicine residency at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, before completing his fellowship in gastroenterology and hepatology at the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston. His professional passions include colorectal cancer prevention, helping patients improve quality of life related to GI symptoms, as well as treating inflammatory bowel disease. Join us as we discuss the overwhelming value of colorectal cancer screening, what to do for aggravating heartburn, and ways to manage a variety of other bothersome GI symptoms. Well, Dr. Spiceland, thanks for joining me today on this episode of our podcast. I'm really looking forward to getting into some of these details about really how one's gastric health can really play a major role in kind of their overall health plan. So thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited.
And I'm glad to know after we kind of prepared for this talk that a couple of areas that I think our listeners and our members will really benefit from are actually areas of your personal passion. So that was really exciting.
Yeah.
Exciting to hear.
I was excited to see some of the topics for today because as I was going through them, I thought, well, this is what I talk to my patients about, and this is what
Great.
I talk to, you know, patients that you send over about, and it's just, I think it's going to fit well for the podcast.
Great. Well, as we start, I just want you to kind of introduce yourself to our listeners. Tell us a little bit about, you know, through all the medical options, you landed on a career as a gastroenterologist.
Perfect. Yeah, so I grew up in Western Kentucky, and my first exposure to medicine, I shadowed the family practitioner in my town.
Cool.
And so I was the guy who called you back and took your vital signs and roomed his patients. And so my initial thought with medicine was that's what I wanted to do, you know, because that was what I had seen. And so once I got into medical school and exposed to other areas, you know, my initial thought was I was going to do hematology oncology. So I loved taking care of, you know, those patients with cancer and these patients that were very sick. And so I pursued internal medicine. And in internal medicine, that's really where I got my first exposure to GI. And, mm-hmm. you know, my thought was, you know, that's the one specialty or one of the few specialties where, you know, with the right screening test, you can actually prevent the cancer in the first place. And so that was really what drew me to mm-hmm. GI was the ability to kind of be that step before the patients were diagnosed with cancer to ideally prevent them in the first place.
Great. Well, you're speaking our language in primary care. You know, we're all about prevention. And obviously, one of the most common referrals we make is to you for those colonoscopies or those screening methods. So let's dive right in there to the cancer discussion. So, you know, I really want to start by asking why it seems, because this could be incorrect, but it seems like we are seeing gastrointestinal cancers, colorectal cancers earlier in one's life. I think that's evidenced by even just within the last few years, the general guideline dropping from age 50 down to 45. But tell me a little bit about, if that's accurate, why that may be the case in your opinion.
Yeah, so definitely. So not only does it seem that way, unfortunately, when we look at the data, that is happening. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we hear it a lot in the news, or, you know, maybe a celebrity's been diagnosed at an early age, or unfortunately, sometimes we know somebody who has, or us in medicine, you know, we see it. So it is happening. You know, as far as why that's happening, there's a lot of different theories. I don't think anybody knows the exact mm-hmm. reason, but there's a lot of contributing factors. You know, I think to sum it up, I would say lifestyle is probably the biggest factor. You know, a lot of the things that you see people for in primary care, you know, a healthy weight, the diet that they eat, you know, some of the ways that they live their life, whether that's, you know, alcohol, tobacco, a lot of those exposures, unfortunately, you know, with a combination of those mm-hmm. is the thought that those are allowing people to have that diagnosis at an earlier age.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And, you know, it's such a complex you know, origin story of cancer. It'll always be hard to probably pinpoint one or two things, but it is that whole body, that whole philosophy that one needs to take care of themselves with their action, with their stress, with their weight. Everything affects their cancer risk. And it sounds like that's what you're hearing and reading about,
and,
too.
Yeah, you know, with GI specifically, when you think about it practically, the food that we eat sets in our GI tract. And mm-hmm. when we think about what we enjoy eating and what we, you know, probably were designed to eat may be two different things. And a lot of the highly processed foods that we, many of us like to eat are unfortunately probably the things that are increasing our cancer risk the most. You know, our colon is where our waste is setting, and that's where your body gets most of its contact with that processed food that you eat. And so, you know, in my opinion, thinking through that, you know, natural process, that I think that has a lot to do with this increased cancer risk at an earlier age.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask that actually is and before we talk about kind of how to screen for cancer best, let's go ahead and talk about the prevention. Yeah. So you kind of mentioned and allude there, like really considering your diet and maybe limiting some of the highly processed foods may be a very valuable thing for an individual to do. Is there anything else that you recommend from a cancer prevention standpoint as far as a specific way to live one's life?
Yeah, I think, you know, diet would be a huge modifiable factor. And, you know, there are some of those factors, you know, just cancer risk in general would go down, you know, if we don't smoke, if we limit alcohol, you know, if we're exercising. But the diet, I think specifically for colorectal cancer, because of just the physiology of, of that's where the food's interacting with our body, plays a big role. So, you know, a whole food plant-based diet, you know, is likely the best diet to eat for to decrease your colon cancer risk. Now, I don't think it has to be black and white. I don't think you have to avoid all meat, but I think if you, you know, if your goal is to limit your colorectal cancer risk as much as possible, I think, you know, eating mostly fresh fruits and vegetables, whole grains, is going to, you know, do you much better in the long run than, you know, the more processed stuff that unfortunately is more commonly consumed nowadays.
Got it. Well, let's talk about screening techniques. You know, there's a few options out there, and I just want to kind of release you to the wild. Tell me about the screening options that you believe are valid, and maybe even a little bit about the pros and cons of each.
Sure. Yeah. So as a GI doc, this is what I spend most of my time doing is, you know, screening and hopefully preventing colorectal cancer. Mm-hmm. Because even, you know, despite, you know, many of us know the right things to do to change our lifestyle to avoid, you know, cancers, you know, there are certain risks that are not modifiable. Genetics, for example, you know, it is what it is. And so screening is very important for anybody. Even if you're, you know, eating that whole food plant-based diet, or, you know, you're doing all those things right, screening is still so important. So thinking through the options, first I'll hit one on screening age. You know, who should we be screening? And so you said it a few years ago, the recommended screening age went from 50 down to 45. Mm-hmm. And that was because, you know, the average age of colon cancer diagnosis is getting younger and younger. And we're finding when we do colonoscopies on people that, you know, for another reason that are below that age, we're already finding precancerous polyps. And so, you know, all that data combined led to that, that decrease in the age recommendation. So anybody age 45, that's average risk, should be screened. There are also certain people that should be screened earlier. And so family history of colon cancer, or even family history of certain types of polyps, would warrant being screened earlier. So screening modalities, the one that I'm most passionate about, because this is what I do day in and day out, is colonoscopy. And that is the one screening test that could actually prevent a colon cancer. And so, you know, just for the audience, you know, colonoscopy is a procedure that you do when you're sedated. And so there's no pain or discomfort involved. It's usually done at a hospital or a surgery center. It would be, you know, a morning of your time to come in, you know, typically with a ride arranged to be able to take you home because of the you know, procedural sedation. Mm-hmm. And there's a preparation that's involved the day before, but it's a quick, painless procedure that you can do for the physician to investigate for the presence of precancerous polyps. And so that's a term that you know, we may use back and forth in this conversation, but it's a growth that starts small, can get bigger over time, and those are the things that if left there over time can grow into a colon cancer. And mm-hmm. so the ideal situation for any type of cancer would be able to visualize that precancerous lesion and take it out before it has a chance to grow. Now, most organ systems are not amenable to us being able to do that, but for the GI tract and the colon specifically, there's a procedure that, you know, allows us to do exactly that. And so that's why colonoscopy for colon cancer screening is so important, because, you know, not only are we looking for and screening for colon cancers, you know, predominantly we are removing precancerous lesions and thereby hopefully preventing colon cancers down the line.
Mm, great. Yeah, continue.
Yeah, and so, you know, if somebody is interested at all in a colonoscopy, mm-hmm. I think that's the best test for them because, like I said, that can be a preventative test. There are people though who hear that and they say, hey, that's not I'm not ready for that, or that's, you know, I can't make that happen right now, or for whatever reason that's not going to be the route that they go. So thankfully there are other screening options. I think the combination of the fecal immunochemical and DNA test, which we commonly know as Cologuard, mm-hmm. is the best option for those folks. And so, you know, if somebody is truly average risk, meaning that they don't have a family history of colon cancer, they've never had a personal history of polyps on a colonoscopy, Cologuard is a fine test for them. It's a stool-based test that actually gets sent to their house. They submit a sample, they send it back in. And if the Cologuard is negative, then that would provide adequate screening for them for a 3-year period. And so mm-hmm. if somebody's just not ready to consider a colonoscopy, Cologuard is definitely better than not being screened. Mm. Now, you know, the caveat is if the Cologuard comes back positive, so if there's blood in the sample, or if there's DNA changes that are present, that person would then definitely need a colonoscopy because they're going to have proven themselves to be a little higher risk based on that test result.
Yeah, great. Now, are those the two types of screening that you would recommend at this point based on the advances that have been made in the last handful of years?
Exactly. You know, there are other screening tests that were previously performed, but I think the two to consider, realistically, are the colonoscopy or the Cologuard.
Gotcha. Now, I'm really interested to get your opinion on this. So, you know, I run into this situation often where somebody may have, let's say at 45, their average risk, they have that first colonoscopy and it all looks great. And they're told, hey, this is clear, 10-year follow-up. Well, then I see that individual at 52 and they're like, man, it's been so long. It's been 7 years since my last colonoscopy. And I'm like, well, that's a good point. And I know it's often, you know, typically slow growing changes, and that first colonoscopy is that baseline. But what do you tell individuals like that who have a little bit of concern of waiting maybe the entire length of time that the pathology is kind of dictated?
Sure. Yeah, and that's a question I get all the time because, you know, as we hear about, the example of a celebrity getting a colon mm-hmm. cancer, of course, it's human nature to think, well, you know, that I want to make sure I'm doing everything I can to prevent that. And so, to answer your question specifically, first I would say, you know, for your colonoscopy, you want to make sure that you do everything you can to make sure you get a high quality exam. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there are a lot of factors that go into that. And, you know, there is a lot of variability in colonoscopy just because it's based on so many different factors. And so from a patient standpoint, on your exam, you want to make sure that you do everything you can to, follow the directions with the preparation, because that's going to help your endoscopist make sure that if everything is found on your initial exam. So mm-hmm. so even taking a step back, that's what you want to do. You also want to make sure that you're going to somebody who is giving high quality exams, and your primary care doctor can help you find that right person. But there are so many quality measures for colonoscopy to make sure that mm-hmm. that the endoscopist is taking their time finding and removing lesions. And so, you know, if you're following those initial steps, you know, you can usually you should feel comfortable with the interval that's given to you. Yeah. Because, for example, we use this quality measure called adenoma detection rate, meaning how often on a screening exam do you find and remove a precancerous polyp? The threshold for, you know, kind of competency is about 25%. So one in every four colonoscopies and endoscopy, an endoscopist should be finding a precancerous polyp. But with the technology mm-hmm. that we have today, if you're, if you're using good technique and good technology, I mean, my adenoma detection rate is upwards of 60%. And so if you're going to somebody mm-hmm. who's giving you good, high quality exams, you're very likely to be coming back at a sooner interval anyway, because, you know, it's going to be more of a rarer occurrence that you're being told to come back in 10 years. And mm-hmm. so I think the first step is just making sure your initial exam, is done the right way. After that, if you've had a good high quality exam, then I would say just monitoring for any symptoms would be the best option, rather than, you know, worrying, you know, should you be back before that interval? Mm-hmm. So what symptoms should a patient, even if they've had a colonoscopy, be worried about? Blood in the stool, a change in their bowels, new abdominal pain. And when I say a change in their bowels, I mean, somebody who used to go to the bathroom every day, but now all of a sudden they're going every 3 days, or, the shape of the stool has changed, or the consistency has changed. There are lots of things that could explain those findings, but it's very difficult, for a patient to kind of tease that out themselves. That's why we help patients decide, hey, is there been a big enough change that we should just do this sooner? Because, even if you've had a colonoscopy or any screening exam, you definitely want to be watching symptoms, because, things can change, and we want to make sure we're staying on top of that.
Yeah. No, those are great bullet points there. Things to be aware of: a change in the bowel movement, or even the consistency or shape of the stools, new abdominal pain, or blood in the stool. Those are always things, regardless of when your last colonoscopy was done, to make sure you're paying attention to. That's great. Fascinating stat you gave: 1 in 4 colonoscopies should be finding precancerous polyps.
That's the threshold. Yeah.
So that's fascinating. Just as you say that, I think to myself, all the colonoscopies I've looked at lately, I do see fewer and fewer 10-year follow-ups. And so that may be one of the reasons you see that. It's just higher quality colonoscopies are actually finding those.
And as our imaging has gotten better, as there are now different modalities that we can add to the typical colonoscopy, such as artificial intelligence, polyp detection, which is what I use, just to help improve polyp detection rate. Because, you're going in for this test, you want it to be as high quality as possible. You're doing all the work, you're taking off work, you're doing the prep, you're arranging a ride. You want to make sure that, you're doing everything you can to make sure you're getting a high quality exam. And so thankfully, the higher the polyp detection rate or adenoma detection rate, the lower risk of interval cancer. So every percentage of adenoma detection rate goes up, colon cancer risk goes down 3%. And so it makes such a big difference to make sure you're getting a good exam.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I've always, worked with you and respected you for the work you've done and the manner you take with patients. But now, knowing that when other referrals are placed, to really consider, okay, what's the quality of the test I'm getting? And even having more terminology that I can use and that patients can use to say, okay, if I'm going to invest the time, the effort, and the risk in getting a colonoscopy done, I want to make sure it's, confident.
Sure.
So that's great. That's great. Any value, and this is a curiosity question, because I've seen this used at times and talked about a little bit, but what is the role, if any, of aspirin in colon cancer prevention and or post-cancer treatment?
Yeah. So for prevention, there is that's a hot topic, because there are some studies that show in folks that are on aspirin or on certain NSAIDs for a different reason, looking at big populations, that cohort had a lower risk of colon cancer. Now, the data is not to a point that I would recommend somebody who doesn't have a reason to be on aspirin to take it just for that reason. There are a few rare circumstances. If someone has a polyp syndrome or something like that, that is not a common circumstance. But I think there's going to be more data forthcoming. Could that be a part of the preventative strategy? But I think if you have patients that are on aspirin for a different reason, I think one of the quote side effects could be a decreased risk of colon cancer.
Gotcha. Thank you. Well, let's shift gears a little bit away from cancer, unless there's anything you want to be sure to add before we transition away to another topic.
No, I think we covered that.
Great. Well, let's shift gears to something I know you're also passionate about. And, we focused on cancer, but there's so many other reasons that people come to see you. So tell me maybe some of the most common things and reasons people find themselves in your office. And let's just start there and see where the conversation goes.
Perfect. Yeah. Thankfully, most of the people that get sent over to me, don't end up having, colon cancer or Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis or some of these GI conditions that we think of. Most of the people that come to see me are coming because their quality of life is negatively affected by some of their GI symptoms. Now, whether that be heartburn or bloating or irregular bowel habits or abdominal pain, those are the most common referrals I see. And honestly, those are the most those are the most interesting referrals I see, because there's some thought involved. There's good conversations with patients about diet, about lifestyle, about you know, other medical problems that could be leading to these symptoms, and it just leads to conversation with and the ability for me to follow that patient longitudinally and get to know the patient, because as a specialist, you know, that is one of the negatives of being a specialist. You know, with primary care, you oftentimes are getting to see people back and you develop a relationship, and a lot of times as a specialist, you know, somebody gets sent to me for their colonoscopy and I see them briefly and we'll do the procedure, and I might see them in 5 years or in 3 years, and you know, I love the other side, to where I'm getting to see somebody longitudinally, help them with a problem they're having, and thankfully most of the time we are able to help them with these quality of life problems. And yeah, like I said, thankfully most of the time it doesn't represent something concerning underlying. A lot of times it is just a symptom that is affecting the way that they live, and it may affect their sometimes even their ability to go to work or their ability to enjoy their life. And when I can help people with things like that, it's extremely fulfilling.
Yeah. What are some of the conversations you often have with patients with those quality of life symptoms? Yeah. You know, is it, and maybe, you know, and I don't want to gadget directly, but like, you know, a bloating or an abdominal discomfort, or even maybe some looser stools that can come about periodically. Like, where do you start the conversation, and ultimately, what kind of remedies or treatments are you recommending to them?
Yeah. So when I see somebody the first time, you know, the first thing that I do is kind of a complete review of those symptoms and just make sure there's nothing that I would consider a red flag symptom that would make me think, hey, we should sooner rather than later investigate this more invasively, usually with an endoscopy or a colonoscopy. Now, most of the time, some of the time, part of this workup has already been done. Maybe they've seen another gastroenterologist, or maybe they've already got some testing done by their primary care, and I review that, and then we start going through, what's been done and what can we think about next. You know, using bloating, for example, just because that's one of the most common things I see people for. You know, oftentimes, you know, we start with, hey, have you been screened for celiac disease? You know, we'll do a lab test for celiac, or if there's another reason to do an endoscopy, the gold standard for diagnosis, ruling in or ruling out celiac, is a duodenal biopsy on upper endoscopy. So, if they have a family history or they have a really high suspicion, you know, sometimes we do talk about an endoscopy sooner rather than later, but you know, a lot of times if it's more of a vague symptom, we may just do the lab test for celiac and then, you know, kind of go from there.
Mm-hmm. Great. What other symptoms do you have kind of a thought around and a symptom kind of treatment plan for? Like you say, when you maybe dive into a more diagnostic workup initially, but maybe shifting gears toward more of the therapeutic options for patients with whether it's symptoms that land within like a functional dyspepsia type situation or an irritable bowel syndrome, kind of tell me where you take them therapeutically once those red flag conditions have been ruled out.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, so functional dyspepsia, we start with that, which is typically, you know, from a patient perspective, abdominal discomfort or bloating or burning in the upper part of the abdomen. Once we've ruled out some other conditions, oftentimes we'll refer that to functional dyspepsia. So, if I was talking to a patient, we were at that point, what am I going to be thinking about? I'm going to be thinking about what other medicines are they, what medicines are they taking? Mm-hmm. Because there's many medicines that patients take, whether it's on their medication list or not, whether it's a supplement or an over-the-counter thing that can cause, some gastric irritation that can lead to that symptom. So I kind of do a full medication review. And then we start talking about diet, because that is that's the spot where things can kind of slip through the cracks. And, as a primary care doctor, you guys are having to talk to patients about, all their different problems. And I get the luxury of just focusing on one. So sometimes, if I can take a little more time and just kind of start going through the diet and things, I'll hear something that will kind of perk my ears to say, okay, well, maybe we need to dive into this a little more. Mm-hmm. Because oftentimes, it can be something that we can tease out. Now, sometimes, there's no inciting medication and there's no clear, dietary thing. And so there are other ways that we can treat those symptoms to improve quality of life, even though there may not be some serious underlying cause.
Mm. A lot of patients ask me about supplements, and Specifically, you know, the most common one might be probiotics. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts on probiotics and or other GI supplements that you feel like either may have some real usefulness in specific patients or the general population, or maybe not as much usefulness.
Sure. Yeah. Probiotics specifically are such a common thing that gets brought up by patients because, mm-hmm. you know, if you go to the pharmacy or, you know, Walmart, I mean, there's rows and rows of different ones. So of course they, you know, they must be good things. They wouldn't mix them.
That's right.
Right.
Yep.
I spend a lot of my time kind of counseling patients on different things. So I definitely think there's a role for probiotics. I think first, you know, bigger picture, you know, the microbiome is a term that gets thrown around a lot. It is the term for the microorganisms, typically, you know, bacteria that live in our GI tract, most in our colon, that, you know, are really there for a reason. I mean, they're for a good reason, to help us digest our food, to help kind of keep an immune balance. And there's a lot of good things about that. But that microbiome can get adjusted by so many things. So other medications, other things we're exposed to, infections, and predominantly the food that we eat. So, you know, probiotics can help. They can adjust the microbiome. So if somebody's got chronic loose stools and they haven't tried a probiotic, a lot of times, you know, I'll try them on a high quality probiotic. You know, how do you determine what's a high quality probiotic? Well, there's a few that have actually been studied kind of independently, not specifically funded by the drug company that makes it. And so those are the ones that I lean towards. Right. And so, you know, giving somebody a trial of that is very reasonable, especially if they've got some risk factors to argue that microbiome may have been adjusted by something, recent antibiotic exposure, recent infection. And those are the people just in practice that I see really benefit from a probiotic. Mm. I don't generally recommend a probiotic for, you know, quote, gut health you know, just to stay healthy. I don't think there's much data to support that's needed. You can imagine if you think through, you know, the amount of food you eat in a day, for example, you know, put it on a plate in your mind versus the size of a probiotic, you know, which do you think is going to have the biggest effect on your microbiome? And of course, it's the food. You know, what we eat is going to play such a larger role into the makeup of our probiotic than the pill. So, you know, I don't say that to say that there's not a role for it, because there definitely is. But I think it's in those specific circumstances, rather than, hey, you should take this for your general health. I think if somebody comes to the question of the general health, that's the perfect opportunity to say, okay, what are you eating? You know, what's your daily probiotic that you're taking in rather than the, you know, the pill you're taking.
That's really good. I love that visual of, like, think of all the three or four plates you might have during a day versus that little capsule, which is going to have the more influence. That's great. So, well, let's shift gears to another common topic. Heartburn, indigestion, reflux, kind of whatever people may kind of land on and how they describe it. But that classic kind of upper lower chest, upper abdominal burning or pain that typically occurs after meals. How should a patient be thinking of that in terms of what to do initially? And then let's transition to how maybe a primary care doc should be thinking about it in terms of when to connect them with you for further diagnostics.
Perfect. Yeah, and that's just another common thing that I see, whether that's a referral or a patient, you know, calling me about it, you know, whether, you know, quality of life issue. So mm-hmm. thinking through heartburn, I mean, what is happening when somebody feels that symptom? That muscle between the esophagus and the stomach is relaxing, and stomach contents are coming up and aggravating the lining of the esophagus. So that's what reflux is. It is common. I think from a patient standpoint, if it is a super rare occurrence after you eat too much Mexican food, you know, it is unlikely to be, you know, a concerning thing. Now, if it is happening two or three times a week, then I think it's something that it's definitely worth mentioning to your primary care doctor. There are some lifestyle factors that I think, you know, a patient on their own or through the help with a primary care doctor can make to try to make that symptom happen less often. Just kind of quickly going through some things to think about. You know, if the person is overweight or obese, thinking weight loss, thinking the amount of food, the type of food, and the timing of eating. You know, the later we eat, We can all imagine a situation in which we've had really bad heartburn. You know, we stayed up too late, we ate too much, and then we laid down. You know, and gravity's no longer keeping stuff in. So, you know, thinking if you imagine that scenario, then you can think of the three things that can make heartburn better. You know, smaller portions, eating earlier, and then staying upright after you eat. That's just going to decrease the risk of stuff coming up and aggravating you. So if you are doing those things and you're still experiencing heartburn, I think that is something you should mention to your primary care doctor, and probably something your primary care doctor would be, you know, should consider sending to a gastroenterologist.
Yeah.
Whether or not, you know, you start an acid reducer, if somebody's having that frequent of heartburn, it probably should be evaluated, especially if somebody has certain other risk factors. So, if somebody's over the age of 45 and has those symptoms, I take those a little more serious than, if somebody's 20 and has those symptoms, because the older any of us are, the risks of the certain other things increase just with age. So if I'm seeing somebody in clinic and they've got certain risk factors, if they've got heartburn that's been there for a while, they're of a certain age, usually 45 or 50, I'm already thinking, about an endoscopy, especially if it's a male, especially if they've got a family history of esophagus cancer, especially if they drink alcohol, or especially if they smoke, because esophagus cancer, the biggest risk for that is reflux, because, it's not just, I mentioned quality of life symptoms, and heartburn definitely is a quality of life symptom, but the physiology of acid coming up and aggravating the lining of the esophagus is not a benign condition. Mm-hmm. That is a condition that can lead to, downstream effects. And it's that increased risk of esophagus cancer that we worry about.
Yeah.
And so, there is that, there's an intermediate step of development of something called Barrett's esophagus, which is precancerous cells in the lining of the esophagus, that if they're there, we can surveil that person more frequently. We would definitely treat with an acid reducer to decrease the risk of that progressing. But heartburn, of all these symptoms we've talked about, heartburn is one that I definitely take a little more seriously, because there are some negative consequences, not just that quality of life.
Absolutely. Well, let's go in a little bit into the treatment options with these acid reducers. So, typically when I meet somebody, they've already, they've been doing the Tums for however long, and then they may have even picked up a pack of over-the-counter acid reducers. So I love the list that you kind of gave of where this really needs to be treated more seriously. I really hang my hat on, the fact that if people are experiencing without really identifiable triggers, and if it starts occurring maybe two or three times a week or more, and it's a little less explainable, we need to treat it a little more aggressively. So when we start treatment, what should we start with? How should we progress it? Tell me what to do here.
Perfect. Yeah. So once it's I've identified a patient that with chronic reflux, with this physiology that we described, the recommendation is to treat it. Of course the patient wants to treat it because they want to feel better, but also we're treating it to protect the lining of the esophagus and prevent those downstream things. So a proton pump inhibitor is I would say the most common, first line thing that I'm going to treat somebody with for reflux. And I do that for a couple of reasons. One is it works relatively quickly. It for almost everyone, it can get their symptoms under control. And for many people, we can treat them with a course of treatment and then back down in the dose or get them off of the treatment. Mm-hmm. And so the alternative option would be to start with what's called a histamine blocker, which is a little bit weaker acid reducer, but it does not carry with it any significant risk. And I would say that's kind of the build up option, is starting with the histamine blocker and building up to the proton pump inhibitor or the PPI. But in practice, what I normally do, treat with a PPI, get symptoms under control, mm-hmm. and then back down. Because if you think about it, the reason I think of it that way is because endoscopically, when you see someone that has really, really bad reflux and they have esophagitis on the inside, we need to heal that up. You can imagine that if we're just barely treating it, if we don't ever get it under control to the point that heals up, they're never going to get the symptom relief, or we're never going to get the risk reduction if we don't just kind of commit to, oftentimes an 8-week course of a PPI mm-hmm. to heal things up. And then, oftentimes, even a patient perspective, they say, "Hey, do I need to stay on this medicine?" Because they've heard or they've read that there can be some risks associated with proton pump inhibitors, and then that opens the door to a good conversation of balancing those risks. Because I do believe there are some risks to long-term proton pump inhibitor use, but there are definitely risks to uncontrolled reflux. And so it's balancing that. And that's usually patient specific. But those are good conversations that I have in clinic. In general, my advice is if we can get somebody's symptoms controlled off of a PPI, that would be great, because they're going to get the benefit of symptom control without accepting any risk. But in reality, that's not possible for everybody. Yeah. There are patients who are maximizing all those lifestyle measures that, we've healed up their esophagitis by a course of proton pump inhibitor. We're tapering them down and they're going to have symptoms. And so we have conversations of, hey, there may be some small risks to this medicine, but there are risks to having your reflux uncontrolled, not to mention the quality of life benefit they're having. And many patients elect to stay on it.
Yeah. Yeah. What are some of the risks that you've seen with long-term PPI use? Yeah.
The risks that I've, so in general, this is, this is the hot topic. I bet most people listening to this have probably heard about, some concerns related to long-term PPI use. Some of the concerns that have been brought up are very scary things. And I understand why patients would be worried about this. There's been questions of association with dementia or chronic kidney disease or any of these scary things. And when you look at the data, I've not seen anything that really links any kind of cause and effect with those things. Mm-hmm. And the reason I mention those is because I get asked those almost every day. So those are things patients are wondering about.
Yeah.
What I have seen some strong associations with is osteopenia, osteoporosis, probably has to do with calcium absorption, with lowering the pH of the stomach contents, with raising the pH of the stomach contents. So when I think through patients specifically in general, in women who are more at risk of those things anyway, I'm more likely to try to get a woman off of a PPI, mm-hmm. because as a female, that woman would be lower risk of esophagus cancer just based on their gender, and higher risk for weaker bones anyway based on the gender. Yeah. And for a man, it's opposite. I'm more likely to keep a male on a PPI because their esophagus cancer risk is higher, and their risk of decreased bone health with age is a little bit lower. And so, there are more intricacies, but in general, that's kind of my framework of what I think about.
Very good. Well, and I love how you were talking about balancing the risk, because chronic medication use may carry a risk, even if uncertain, the answer isn't to tolerate those symptoms more and let the disease process take a deeper hold. And esophagitis to worsen and Barrett's to develop and possibly cancer to develop. So, so the answer is not let's avoid meds and just deal with the symptoms. It is to find that balance of, okay, well, how do we appropriately treat? And I love that thought.
Yeah. And I have those conversations probably every day in clinic, and I get it from a patient standpoint. I mean, it's very easy to think about, I'm actively accepting this risk. I'm taking this pill and I'm swallowing it. Mm-hmm. I'm introducing this risk into my life. It is kind of harder to comprehend of the acceptance of risk by not taking the medicine.
Yes.
A lot of times the patient's like, well, I don't want to be on medicine, or I don't want to take this medicine. I'll just kind of tough it out. And with some symptoms, that there would probably be very little risk to that. But with heartburn, I would caution people of doing that, because there's risk to that.
Yeah, it's a great point to make. When it comes to PPI use, do you have a favorite PPI that you feel like is most effective or best tolerated by individuals?
I usually start with omeprazole for a lot of reasons. It's been out a while. Oftentimes it's insurance preferred, and it is one of the stronger ones. In fact, a lot of the studies when comparing the efficacies measuring omeprazole equivalents, showing that's kind of the standard. Almost always I start with omeprazole. If someone has a reason they shouldn't be on that one, or drug interaction, or if sometimes after somebody's been on one for a while, it may lose some effectiveness, then I'll switch to pantoprazole. And those are the two that I use mainly.
Great. And then I think you mentioned, but I want to be clear. So sometimes if you're going to really heal endoscopy diagnosed esophagitis, you may go with a pretty aggressive dose for maybe two months, 8 weeks,
yes.
and then start backing it down, and then allowing the patient's symptoms to really direct, okay, hey, do we need to stay on this for a while or are we free to come off?
Yeah, that's what I do almost always. Now, there are, you know, if someone has Barrett's, for example, that person should stay on a PPI. Mm-hmm. When I look with an endoscopy, we grade the esophagitis. And if someone's got a more severe esophagitis, I'm much more likely to recommend that they stay on a proton pump inhibitor. But for most people, you know, if they've got mild esophagitis, we're doing it based on their symptoms. And, you know, especially if they had symptoms before, because we know that they are feeling their reflux. There's a subset of people that have, quote, silent reflux. Mm-hmm. And so it's harder in those people because they may be having inflammation that they're not noticing. So that is a little bit different category. But for the general person, we're going to base it on their symptoms. And I'm going to at least give them a try of trying to get off the proton pump inhibitor.
Great. So from my perspective as their primary care doc, if I'm seeing a patient who is relying on PPIs to manage their symptoms and they're needing it multiple times a week for multiple weeks in a row, I need to be sending them for an endoscopy.
I think in general, I would agree with that. You know, screen them for Barrett's, assess the anatomy. There are some folks that have a anatomic risk factor called a hiatal hernia that is really relaxing that muscle and allowing reflux to come up. And so to assess for both of those, I think it's important to send them over.
Very good. Well, Dr. Spiceland, as we kind of land today, I just want to kind of get your feel for if there's anything on the horizon in your world, in the gastroenterology world, that you're kind of excited about. Maybe a new technology, a new procedure, a new medication, anything that you hear about on the horizon that we should get excited about.
Yeah, a few things. I think one, and I alluded to this, is the use of artificial intelligence to help prevent colon cancer. So during the screening colonoscopy, I think it's becoming commonplace enough that you can ask, hey, are you using any kind of artificial intelligence to increase polyp detection rate, because many places are now. I think that, you know, like we said, we want to make sure you're getting the highest value and quality procedure that you can. And so that's one thing. The other thing is and I even though this probably doesn't apply as much to a general audience, but the advances in inflammatory bowel disease, so Crohn's mm-hmm. disease and ulcerative colitis are things that I see and I'm passionate about. The medications that we have to treat those diseases, you know, I'm sure we all see the commercials for, so are becoming, more efficacious and safer, as well as the ways that we have to assess those patients without making them have so many repeat endoscopies and colonoscopies is getting better. Stool testing for inflammation, a test called a fecal calprotectin we are using a lot that just a few years ago wasn't commonplace. And then even using intestinal ultrasound to assess for inflammation mm-hmm. in those patients. So the field of inflammatory bowel disease, thankfully for those patients, is becoming better and better.
That's great. So many conversations to come down the road. Sure. So, well, obviously our Brentwood MD office here in Brentwood, your office in South Nashville, tell our listeners how they can connect with you and tell us about your practice.
Perfect. Yeah. So my practice is gastroenterology specialist of Middle Tennessee. Right now, the best way would be to talk to your primary care doctor about having a referral sent over, because we want to make sure that, we're the right place to be able to take care of your specific issue. And so that's the best way to do it right now. As far as my practice, it's pretty balanced. So I enjoy seeing patients in clinic. And so in the mornings, I'm performing endoscopies. In the afternoon, I'm seeing patients in clinic. And I love both. I love doing the screenings and the evaluations with the colonoscopy and endoscopy like we talked about, but also just love seeing and talking to patients, that developing that longitudinal relationship where, I've got those patients I can see back and, get to know them, get to know their families. And, it's a great balance of both.
That's great. Great. Well, Dr. Spiceland, thanks again for taking the time to join me for this conversation. I think there was tons of value here. So a lot of areas we can even go deeper into in the future. So thanks for being with me and giving this to the audience.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
I want to thank you for listening to this conversation. I truly hope you found it useful. You can find out more about today's episode and discover additional content at brentwoodmd.com/podcast. If you haven't subscribed, please do so. We would be honored if you would leave a review or even a recommendation for a future conversation you would like to hear. If you would like to learn more about the concierge services that we provide at Brentwood MD, email us at membership@brentwoodmd.com. We'd love to meet you. This podcast was for general information only and does not constitute the practice of medicine or giving of medical advice, as no doctor-patient relationship has been formed. The content of this podcast is not intended to substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Listeners should seek the advice of their own trusted medical professionals.